With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Unleashed on TNT. I'm your host, Mark Morano. All right. John Kerry, the climate envoy, the former presidential candidate, the former U.S. Secretary of State for the United States of America, has weighed in on some hefty foreign policy analysis of Russia, Ukraine, the climate agenda. Let's take a look at what the intellectual John Kerry has to say about Russia. Clip one.
I am 100% certain, having followed this saga for these years, that we will get to a low-carbon, no-carbon economy in this planet. We will. What I'm not certain of, and what I don't think anybody can be certain of, is that we are going to get there in time to do what the scientists told us in the 2018 report that we need to do, which is make the decisions now and implement them. This was 5 years ago. They said you have 12 years left within which to put in place the decisions that will avoid the worst consequences of the climate crisis. They didn't say avoid the crisis altogether. They said avoid the worst consequences.
Okay, that's John Kerry talking about 100% confidence. My next clip will be about him talking about Russia. But he literally is just claiming that we're almost at the promised land. Just stick with me. We're almost there. We're a few steps away from this net zero panacea of the world. And I was on Fox Business yesterday, right after the conclusion of this show, actually, and was asked to weigh in. Yesterday, of course, was John, well, not of course, I don't think a lot of you are following this, but it was John Kerry's last official day as the United States climate envoy. So this was me analyzing what John Kerry was up to and his legacy. This is, I guess it would be the final clip, Morano on Fox.
He believes that these countries like Russia, China, the Middle East pledges, Venezuela, he literally tries to get them to make these climate commitments, chastises them if they don't, although he never chastises China at all. And all that ends up happening is all these countries love the fact that the West is committing industrial suicide by shutting down our domestic energy, making us more reliant on them. So the idea that Russia is going to worry about a climate pledge from a U.S. climate envoy to the U.N. climate process is laughable. But it's also true of China. The Associated Press had an article about 3 weeks ago talking about John Kerry's legacy. This was the corporate media from the Associated Press saying that John Kerry is saving grandchildren of the future, that future generations will look back and thank him because of what he's done with his Chinese counterpart. This is truly a moment where we should behold and say good riddance to John Kerry. The problem is no one quite knows where he's going, and he may actually end up doing more damage at his next gig.
And that's the interesting thing. The latest reports are it's quite unclear why John Kerry's leaving and where he's actually going. So that's one of the things we're trying to investigate. Originally, it was said he was going off to help Biden's reelection campaign. I don't know about you, but a failed presidential candidate, a climate envoy with a budget of $17 million and flying around the world, I don't know what he brings to Biden's campaign. He's also said that he literally stayed too long in his job and that he wants to move on. Well, it's moving over to John Podesta now. And John Podesta is out there now. Basically, he's doing the same thing he did when he worked for the Obama administration. He is telling people when Obama was president that we needed a cap and trade climate tax in the United States because the storms were getting so bad. And the problem is, there's no way, as John Kerry has pointed out multiple times, you could pit one U.S. climate envoy against another U.S. climate envoy. Nothing the United States does could even impact global emissions, let alone even theoretically global temperatures or global storminess or any other kind of ridiculous medieval witchcraft measure you want to put to it. But John Kerry has rightly said we could go to zero and have no impact. Well, John Podesta is actually being investigated now by a joint congressional committee because he's not going to be appointed, approved. He's going to just be working at his perch, not from the State Department like John Kerry did, but from the White House in an unappointed, unelected position where he's going to wield huge international relations power. He'll be able to make pledges on behalf of the U.S. As we continue to shut our energy down and make more reliance on China, Venezuela, Middle East, Russia, etc. And this just keeps going and going and going. It is the most bonkers agenda. Let's see if I got this right. This is Kerry, Russia. This should be clipped. Let's try this again. This is what John Kerry had to say about Russia. Roll Kerry, Russia.
Russia has the ability to be able to make enormous changes if it really wanted to. I mean, if Russia has the ability to wage a war illegally and invade another country, they ought to be able to find the effort to be responsible in the climate issue. Unfortunately, because of the actions that Russia took in an unprovoked, illegal war against another nation, we have not been engaged in discussions with Russia, sadly. I say sadly because it's a loss for the world not to be able to have Russia acting constructively on this issue. But we need every country, including Russia. Russia is one of the largest emitters in the world. If Russia wanted to show good faith, they could go out and announce what their reductions are going to be and make a greater effort to reduce emissions now. And maybe that would open up the door for people to feel better about what Russia is choosing to do at this point in time.
This is quite funny. I mean, Russia has been portrayed as the destroyer of U.S. election integrity. That's allegedly they hacked the 2016 election. The deep state, the ruling class, the corporate media have been railing on Russia, 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 right? Russia invades Ukraine. They go, that's every economic sanction in the world, efforts to ask Elon Musk to decommission any cars in Russia, to punish Russian citizens. Every bank, every financial institution in the Western world boycotted Russia. Guess what? They're doing just fine. Article after article in the corporate media is acknowledging it didn't hurt Russia. All it did was push Russia over to an alliance with China and India and these other countries. And we're closer to the day now where the U.S. dollar is not going to, the petrodollar will cease to exist, where all the world's currency and trade is going to be based on U.S. currency, which would be quite a blow to our economic hegemony or whatever phrase you want to use. And so John Kerry is now just saying all Russia has to do is just make some pledges, just come out and say, hey, we care about climate. And but within 3 decades, we're going to reduce emissions 30%. They would be loved. And how do I know they would be loved by the ruling class? The Taliban. The Taliban was loved by the ruling class. It was CBS News, Newsweek, whole articles about, even though the U.S. has pulled out of Afghanistan, this would have been August of 2021 when we pulled out, the disastrous pullout. I'm not saying we shouldn't have pulled out, but we shouldn't have pulled out the way we did, leaving all our equipment for the Taliban. But glowing articles in the corporate press about how the Taliban cared about climate change and how the Taliban we could work with on the climate agenda. This is what we're supposed to be thinking about. It's incredible. The same things were said. Yeah, I think it was about Osama bin Laden actually made climate comments. And so there's always this idea that we can reach out to people because of a common agenda, because it's a common earth and we can make pledges together. The problem is these pledges they're making have no impact on global emissions. Last year, I call it the net zero bust. The International Energy Agency reported that CO2 emissions hit global record highs, unabated, continued to rise, despite every UN climate summit, despite every country's Green New Deal, despite every country's net zero commitments, despite trying to shut down energy, agriculture, despite coming after airline travel, despite gas-powered car bans, despite EV mandates, CO2 emissions still go up. And this is what the ruling class is reduced to. You know, John Kerry, this foreign policy expert, high regarded intellect of the ruling class of the Davos crowd, is out there saying Russia should make some climate pledges and then we'll all be nice to him. I don't think Russia gives a flying beep what the West is going to do to them at this point. They found their alliance with China. They found their true independence. with this whole nonsense. And I was reading an article about economic sanctions just don't work, have never worked. And it's just another form of virtue signaling that has unintended consequences normally. So that is the latest on the John Kerry update and all that. So the other thing I wanted to mention was along these same lines, the way they talk about Russia, and this is when it all really started in terms of just going after it, was the 2016 election, the Russian hacking. They hacked our election and Hillary Clinton screaming foul and all of the MSNBC and CNN crowd claiming that the election, they were election deniers, if you will, about 2016. Well, this is interesting because now the court has ruled, Supreme Court has ruled the unanimous decision to put Trump back on the ballot in Colorado, which is going to effectively nullify this whole movement that says Donald Trump is so dangerous, but the American people are so stupid, they may vote for him, but he's too dangerous to allow on the ballot. So we're going to take him off. Well, the Supreme Court says no. This is, I think, clip five, or it's the leftist media in full meltdown mode. This is their reaction of Donald Trump actually having his name on the ballot.
We've learned that it was a 9-0 decision ruling that Donald Trump can be on the ballot in Colorado and other states.
I'm not confident that that will produce a result that's good for American democracy.
This is actually what I had been concerned about. I had been concerned that it should it go to the Supreme Court, they would rule this way.
I'd laugh if it weren't so sad.
My next guest says Donald Trump is still an oath-breaking insurrectionist. Do you have confidence in the Supreme Court? Do you think this court is partisan?
The court itself may have overstepped.
The court went way further than it needed to go.
Our colleague Melissa Murray has called this Supreme Court the YOLO court.
The criticism of the court is that they're playing interference.
Not since Bush v. Gore have we seen a court that's had this many opportunities to interfere in the election.
The headline here is this, that this is a unanimous ruling, but if you scratch the surface just a little.
This is a 5-4 ruling on part of it.
This is actually a 5-4 decision.
It's 5-4.
Trump will take this, spin it, spread the misinformation, disinformation on it. So it's a win for them.
He's on the ballot and voters will vote. And he looks like he's headed to become the Republican nominee for president.
You can't save a people from themselves. If they're determined to reelect him after he organized that insurrection, then there's nothing to stop the people from doing that.
Wow. It's 2024. Corporate media, MSNBC, CNN, anchors, hosts, contributors, analysts are finally just coming to the realization that the people get to decide who to vote for president. Not the ruling class elite, not Democrat attorney generals who do the most absurd charges and change it. In the case of New York, this is important. The rape charge against Donald Trump in New York was well beyond the statute of limitations. So the prosecutor could do nothing to try to smear Donald Trump. And even though the accused never even had a year, a date, any specificity about it, it was just like, you know, just an accusation that Donald Trump couldn't even check his professional, you know, he had kept a calendar and a schedule. They could prove that he was not where he was allegedly raped this woman. The legislator in New York went back and changed the laws for less than a year or maybe 1 year for the statute of limitations, just so this prosecutor could go at and this lawsuit against Trump could go forward. And then once the lawsuit was done, the law reverted back to the old law. That's how in the tank this establishment is to keep the American people from voting for a presidential candidate. And now this is the media, like, you can't protect the American people from themselves. Huh? That's what an election is about. That's how far we've come. And I want to say, yeah, this is how far we've come since 2016. These are all these trends that have been happening globally. But this is pretty darn scary. It's a frightening thing. We saw it happen in Brazil. They're trying to keep Bolsonaro. Like, he can't even legally run back for president. He's what you'd call Brazil's Trump, for lack of a better phrase. This is frightening stuff because they're still trying. And notice the emphasis on all these talking heads and the corporate media about it's a 5-4 vote, 5-4 vote. They just want one more Supreme Court because Democrat justices, Supreme Court justices appointed by Democrat presidents, would rule the other way. They would disqualify Donald Trump from the ballot. That's a frightening scenario. Well, here's a candidate. Well, we don't like that guy. He's a radical. Well, isn't it for the people to decide? What the hell? The people aren't to decide anything. Get him off the ballot. Well, the Supreme Court says that. Well, then change the Supreme. Let's pack the Supreme Court, which is still a very, very real possibility. That's what they talked about. It's happened once in our history with Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s to get his programs through. This is a brave new world. And in fact, it's part of this whole Great Reset World Economic Forum. And this is, you know, how they want to go after. It's a surveillance state. It's an intimidation state. It's a state that gives you no choices, no freedom. This is clip two. This is Queen Maxima of the Netherlands speaking at the World Economic Forum's Davos Summit about the digital IDs and why they're necessary, why we're all going to have to just be a number traced, surveilled, and followed by the state. Take a listen.
When I started this job, there were actually very little countries in Africa or Latin America that had one ubiquitous type of ID, and certainly that it was digital, and certainly that was biometric. And now we really work with all our partners to actually help that being, to grow this. And the interesting part of it is that, you know, yes, it is very necessary for financial services, but not only.
Sure.
You know, it's also good for school enrollment, it's also good for health, who actually got a vaccination or not. It's very good to actually to get your subsidies, you know, from the government.
You hear that? They're going to crush you economically, and then they're going to offer you universal basic income, guaranteed minimum income, as you have no jobs or opportunity. You'll own nothing. You'll be happy. You'll have no private. This is actual tenets of the World Economic Forum. You'll have nothing. You'll have no privacy, but life will never be better. And in order to get these subsidies after government policy, through climate, through Great Reset, through public health and lockdowns and whatever the hell else they want to do, has taken away your economic opportunities, you can't even get minimum benefits from the government unless you have your digital ID. So they're going to force you that way, much the same way, you know, we have a vaccine mandate, but they're not actually, you don't have to get the vaccine. Of course, you can't participate in society if you don't. And we had countries, again, wouldn't allow you to have access to your own bank account unless you got the vaccine. And of course, we know what happened to the Canadian truckers. This is frightening. It's real. It's here. It's happening now. It's not some Chinese dystopian future sometime in, you know, distant future, decades away. It's here and it's now. Now, we have heroes in this fight. Australian Senator Alex Antic has laid bare the tyrannical aspirations of the Great Reset, of Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum. This is clip three. This is great. This is how we have to fight back. We need leaders like this in office speaking in the organs of power. Well, they have power, not retired politicians. Take a listen. Take a look.
Founded in 1971 by Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum is steeped in authoritarianism and Marxist ideology. It's an ideology which is creeping into governments across the world. To quote Schwab himself when speaking about the Canadian Parliament,
"We penetrate the cabinets." So yesterday I was at a reception for Prime Minister Trudeau, and I know that half of this cabinet, or even more, half of this cabinet are actually young global leaders of the World Economic Forum.
That's true in Argentina as well.
It's true in Argentina, and it's true in France now. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the president, with a young global leader.
The World Economic Forum promotes globalist issues such as climate change, so-called systemic racism and sexism, and creating an online digital identity. However, closer inspection reveals the World Economic Forum is an anti-capitalist, anti-free market organisation that seeks to subvert Western values and political processes. And they are very organised and very well funded. Their message is designed to appear harmless when in fact the ideology that underpins it is revolutionary and destructive. They train aspirational leaders in their ideology and help them make connections in spheres including politics, business and the arts. The World Economic Forum has consistently advocated for the harshest and most extreme COVID measures possible, including lockdowns, mandatory vaccinations, vaccine passports and mask mandates, despite these policies assaulting many of our basic liberties.
Wow. Australian Senator Alex Antic, that's the way it's done. That's what needs to be happening daily in media, in government halls, by our leaders, in civic organizations, on talk radio. That's the kind of stuff you hear here at TNT. That's why TNT is so important. This is the greatest threat we face right now. And I mean, when I say that right now, I mean, this is just since March of 2020, the whole world has transformed. On that note, we have Dr. Gilbert Burdeen, a medical doctor fighting for freedom against medical tyranny. He'll be joining us next. He graduated from Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has a degree in sciences. He graduated from Harvard School of Medicine. We are going to have a great discussion about what in the hell is going on in the world of public health, of medicine, doctors. Stay tuned. This is Mark Morano on TNT Unleashed. We'll be right back.
TNT's Abby Roberts.
Church of England seeks partners to create $1 billion fund to address legacy of slavery. Everybody, the Church of England, what are you doing? The Church of England will aim to turn a $100 million financial commitment into a $1 billion fund to address the legacy of slavery in order to reflect the scale of moral sin. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. We need we need to get all those people out of the Church of England. What are they doing? The church should work in partnership with other organisations to create the fund that will be used, and I'm sure not used for any nefarious purposes. Oh no, raising that amount of money surely will not go into the wrong hands. Because that would never happen, would it?
Abby Roberts on TNT.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was going to make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Ladies and gentlemen,
today's news talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is medical doctor Gilbert Burdeen. He is a Harvard medical graduate, and he's also an affiliate of the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University. He is going to analyze for us what in the world has happened in the world of medicine and public health, particularly since 2020. Welcome to the program, Dr. Burdeen.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Let's just start from I think the public's perception. Anyway, most people never when I say most people, the general public never questioned vaccines. I mean, people would get flu shots, they'd get their kids vaccinated. You always had a smaller, I would say, vocal minority who said, I don't like, whether it's Robert F. Kennedy Jr., what people would derisively call the anti-vaxxers. And say, well, it's not mercury, it's not a problem, or all these people are against the latest technology. But essentially, when March of 2020 hit globally and the lockdowns happened and then later followed a year later with all the vaccine mandates, people started taking a second look at all vaccines, I think. And even there was Webster Dictionary redefined vaccine anti-vaxxer as someone who did not support vaccines to someone who didn't support vaccine mandates. They actually changed the definition. So if you could have taken every COVID vax and every other vaccine, but you were still going to be labeled an anti-vaxxer because you didn't support vaccine mandates. So simple question is, let's start with that. What happened in the world of vaccines from a perception of the public, from perception of the medical community? And how's your view of vaccines evolved at all? Even childhood vaccines since the mRNA vaccines were mandated globally throughout the world anyway.
Well, I'm frequently labeled by my colleagues as anti-vax, and I always correct them. I say, I don't have anything against vaccines. I am opposed to forcing people to take vaccines when they don't want to. So I'm opposed to mandates. Now, the COVID vaccine has to be viewed differently from all the previous vaccines for a number of reasons. I'm not sure which ones you want to get into.
Well, let's get to that in a moment specifically, but there seems to be a whole reevaluation of all vaccines. I can just tell you, I live in the state of Virginia, and I know many families now who are questioning not only vaccines for their children, but even the vet vaccines. I mean, there just seems to be a wholesale reexamination. Here's a simple question. Is that warranted? Is the chicken pox, is measles, mumps, rubella.
Rubella.
Rubella. Rubella, yeah. Are those vaccines worth taking a second look at? Do they deserve scrutiny, or are they considered safe and effective? Before we even get to that, let's talk about just general vaccines, because I know a lot of people now who've reevaluated and are truly now anti-vax.
Okay, so that's a great question. We have a lot of experience with chickenpox, measles, mumps. Now, I want to let the audience know that I had all those diseases. I did not get vaccines for any of those diseases. There are questions even regarding those vaccines. I think if you're talking about smallpox, there are very few people who are opposed to smallpox vaccine, very few people opposed to polio vaccines. Once you get into the childhood illnesses, you're getting into a realm where you have these ubiquitous illnesses that happen every year, but very few people get really sick from them. Now, everybody gets a 2 to 3 day illness with fever and whatnot, but very few people get really sick, have serious sequela, or even die. Those are very uncommon with all those diseases. So yes, people should consider the risks and the benefits. I think there are always questions. These respiratory viruses are out there for a reason. They're part of our environment. And in the old days, when I grew up, as I said, everybody got this, they all had the illness. It was not considered a threat in the community. And when a kid came down with chickenpox, the block would have a party and all the neighbors would bring their kids and they'd all get thrown in one room. Everybody would get sick for 2 to 3 days and then be done. And again, very, very low incidence of very serious problems. Now, you can have a debate on those vaccines. We have a lot of experience with them, so there's grounds for debate. There's figures you can talk about in terms of mortality. There's figures you can talk about in terms of vaccine safety. Where things change with COVID is we were taking a completely new product that was not adequately tested and forcing everybody to take it. But I've experienced the same thing in my patient population. The first words out of their mouth is, I'm not going to take the flu vaccine, for example. They don't want any vaccines. And that, you know, I think that's very understandable because basically for about a year, people were lied to.
And as a doctor, do you encourage them to take those vaccines? Like I only took one flu vaccine in my entire life. And I've talked to other doctors who said, basically, it's a crapshoot. There's no real evidence. And I just thought, why would I bother? Let's start with that. Is a flu vaccine something you even recommend, or should it be recommended?
Well, it depends on who you are. Now, I'm a lung doctor, so I take care of people with chronic lung disease. They're at much higher risk for having a serious consequence of influenza. So the calculus is different for those people. I do not recommend, I don't take the flu vaccine. I declined the COVID vaccine too. I don't recommend any of the vaccines to anybody. Now, if a person comes in and said, I want a flu vaccine, I don't try to talk them out of it. I just say, okay, here, we'll get you the flu vaccine if this is what you want. If people ask me questions about it, I will try to answer their questions in an unbiased way. So I would say I'm ambivalent on the vaccines. If people want them, I help them get them. If they don't want them, I don't twist their arm.
All right, well, here's an uncomfortable question. What if you have, say, a 18-year-old, 20-year-old athlete who comes in, male or female, college age, and you know the parents pressuring them to get the COVID / flu vaccine? Would you recommend against that, a perfectly healthy person, or would you give them any negative, or would you just sort of do what they want? What's the doctor's obligation in that situation?
Well, with children, things are a little bit different. I would tell them that an 18-year-old athlete was at very low risk for having any serious sequela from COVID, influenza, or whatever. And I would tell them that, in my opinion, the risks of the, especially the COVID, the risk of the COVID vaccine far outweighs any benefit to the child. And I would say, you know, it's ultimately going to be your decision, but I would say this is a bad gamble for COVID. Now, for influenza, I think it doesn't make any sense to give this child influenza vaccine, because the likelihood of him having a serious problem from flu is almost zero. Now, the downside of the flu vaccine is a lot different. Yes, there are sequelae. I would certainly not want to take the risk. But again, it's not the same as with this COVID vaccine, where the risk side is much different, and for very important reasons.
Now, that which brings up the next question. Is the mRNA COVID vaccine actually a vaccine? I mean, there were old clips of Anthony Fauci, I want to say it was like 2017. I should have had the clip here to play you, where he's actually at some forum talking about how long it's going to take. And he's almost hinting that they need an emergency in order to push these through in the, you know, under rapid authorization to get them through, because otherwise the approval process would take, I guess, a decade or more. Would you classify the mRNA COVID vaccine, or the jab, as a lot of people, because they don't want to call it, as an actual vaccine? Does it meet the definition as a medical doctor to you?
Well, it didn't meet the old definition of vaccine. They had to change it so that it would be consistent with the definition. I don't want to be splitting syllables and things like that. Again, there are very important differences. One, this was a completely new technology, so we had absolutely no idea of the long-term side effects of this new technology. That should have been a red flag right there. The other thing, and I don't think this was malicious, some people do, but I don't think it was malicious. I think it's just they didn't know. So if you take like the pneumococcal vaccine, the vaccine against pneumococcal pneumonia, the antigen used to immunize you is an inert part of the virus. It's the polysaccharide coat. It doesn't do anything. The spike protein, which is the antigen for the COVID vaccine, is poison. Now, they didn't know this when they were developing the vaccine. They thought that this was a good choice for antigen because it was unlikely to change as the virus evolved. And they did not want to have the same problem they have with the influenza vaccine, where the new strains are resistant because they have different DNA. So they chose the spike protein, thinking this isn't going to change and it will allow for a long-lasting vaccine. But it turns out the spike protein is poison. And so basically you are introducing a toxic substance into people. Now, there's not a debate about this. It's just people don't want to admit it.
Now, is this true? Is this still true today? Have they adjusted it? And is this true of every major from Johnson & Johnson to Pfizer, Moderna, all of them you would classify as poison in the spike protein?
Well, I don't know. I have to say I don't keep up on the nuances of each vaccine. Certainly, if you're talking about Pfizer and the Moderna, the original vaccines, the spike protein is poison. It doesn't matter whether you get the spike protein from COVID illness or whether you get it because the vaccine induces your cells to make spike protein. It's poison. It causes very significant problems in all the blood vessels. Now, they originally claimed, well, you're going to get the shot in the arm. It won't leave the arm. Well, that's not true. You can find traces of it everywhere in people who get it. So it clearly is transmitted by the blood to every organ, and every organ has blood vessels, and all of these blood vessels become targets of the spike protein.
Well, now, when you have, I think it was the head of Moderna testifying in front of the EU. This was like last year, and they actually admitted under direct questioning that they never actually tested these mRNA vaccines, whether they stopped transmission. They weren't even tested for that, yet they were immediately, we were told they were safe and effective. And you could watch everyone from the Biden administration to all the corporate media anchors all saying this stops the virus cold. How did they even make those claims? What were they based on? Just hope? Or were there some studies or any due diligence at all done to make that kind of a claim that it stopped the virus cold?
Well, they stretched the truth for sure. So the original studies were done in a relatively small group of people. And basically, they had not had COVID previously. And they were not sick at the time. And then they gave them a vaccine and they watched them for 90 days. And then they looked at how often people developed respiratory symptoms and also tested positive for COVID. So you have a number of problems here. Is if you test positive for COVID, does that mean you have COVID illness? Well, nobody knows. And they certainly weren't eager to sort that out. So they just assumed if you had a positive PCR test, you were COVID. And then they just looked at the differences between how many people developed symptoms and tested positive for COVID in the control group and in the vaccine group. Now, you have to recognize that especially if you take a younger person, if you take someone who's under the age of 40, the likelihood of them dying from COVID is near zero. It's extremely small. So when you're talking about a benefit to that person, well, it's hard to achieve a benefit because they're not going to have a problem to begin with. Now, if you talk about 80-year-old people, well, these people do get sick and they do die. And so this is at least there's a group you can talk about, but the original trials were not specifically targeted for the elderly and people with comorbid conditions. To be fair, we didn't know about that yet, but they had inadequate numbers to really make statements. So when they said 90% efficacy, it meant that your chance of getting a 2 to 3 day cold was reduced from 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000. What they said.
Yeah. Well, I remember Alex.
Now, it was actually true, but it was certainly misleading.
Yes, and I remember there was a surveys done where people who were really concerned about COVID had just completely wrong views of the actual threat level. They thought you had a 1 in 3 chance of dying if you got COVID and things like that. I mean, because the media coverage was incredible, which I want to get to after our break. But just a question, I'm coming at this from a layman's point of view. I have no medical background training, but my understanding is the way mRNA works is it actually does for a few months, maybe up to 6 months, reduce your chance of getting COVID. But after that, you have to be continually boosted to keep it. And then the side effects would eventually outweigh any potential benefits. And of course, you know, why would you be afraid of COVID anyway, unless you had certain comorbidities? And I think it was Alex Berenson who got banned from Twitter at the time in 2021 for saying essentially this is not a vaccine. This is just a, you know, some kind of a treatment that is temporary treatment at best. What are your views on that? Is that a way you could describe this? I mean, it actually does work short term if only worried about the virus, but it doesn't account, not accounting for all the side effects. And the only way to keep it from working and, of course, increase your thing is just the constant boosting, which is what they're promoting now, is constant perpetual boosters.
Right. So in terms of stopping the vaccine, it's not at all clear that that's a worthy goal for young people. Yeah. Young people who are not going to get sick, you, from a strategic point of view, if your goal is to minimize death, from a strategic point of view, you want your young and healthy people to all get the disease right off the bat, and then you're done with it within a week. Then there are no more hosts, and now nobody can transmit the illness to elderly people. So what you ended up seeing that places like Sweden, where they didn't do crazy lockdown things, you know, did better than places like New York, where they went crazy in the opposite direction. And New York had its own set of problems for other reasons. But no, the vaccine does not prevent transmission. There were claims made that if you had no symptoms, you were contagious, and that is flat out wrong, incorrect. It turns out that people who did have symptoms, you could argue that they were infective maybe for 24 or 48 hours prior to the onset of symptoms. But someone who never developed symptoms was never going to transmit the disease to anybody. And again, there are good immunologic reasons for this based on our, we have different levels of immunity and they're not all the same. And the jabs do not improve all these forms of immunity. They only improve the IgM, IgG response.
Okay, we got to take a break. We're talking with Dr. Gilbert Burdeen, someone who is not happy with the way medical science went crazy after 2020. This is Mark Morano on Unleashed. We'll be right back after these messages on TNT.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Was it something he said? Could it possibly have been something he said? I'm sure it's completely coincidental that fewer than 48 hours after New York City Mayor Eric Adams wandered off the Proglodyte plantation decrying the invasion of New York City by illegal aliens, that the top-to-bottom corrupt FBI raided not one, not two, but three of his longtime campaign aides' homes. Adams is now in trouble with the left because he had the temerity to point out that having the status of a sanctuary city hasn't worked out so well for the residents of his city. We always want to support good behavior and reward it in order to encourage more of it. So we're standing with Eric Adams on this issue, and we think that you should too. We need to stop illegal aliens from coming to our country. We need to stop paying them thousands of dollars in healthcare costs, housing costs, food costs, and educational costs. They're here, of course, to crash all those systems and to destroy America from within. Just say no to people who hate America. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for today's News Talk, TNT.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Unleashing the Beast. Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano. All right, we're talking with Dr. Gilbert Burdine, and he's an affiliate of the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University. He's a medical doctor. Okay, I have a question. I have many people I know and on social media, when an athlete has a cardiac arrest, like happened with the Buffalo Bills last year, when a young person gets myocarditis, or when someone dies or gets aggressive cancer, many people will say, oh, that's the COVID vaccine. That's the COVID vaccine. Is there any science to support that? I know with myocarditis, there definitely is. But in terms of early death, when you see people, young people, healthy, is that just anecdotal, or do you actually see a connection between the COVID vaccine and unusual deaths? And of course, there's studies on excess deaths as well. But tell us about that, because in social media and popular culture, a huge segment of the population is convinced every time a young person gets very sick or dies or has unusual symptoms, it's from the vaccine. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to claim that every one of these situations was due to the vaccine, but it would be equally egregious to claim that none of them are due to the vaccine. The first information on this came from the life insurance industry, because claims for deaths in 40-year-olds and younger were off the chart, a 40% increase from previous years. And a 10% increase in that age group corresponds to a 1 in 200 year catastrophe. So 40% is unheard of in the insurance industry for that age group. And it occurred at a time when it was not possible to blame it on COVID, because the cases were near zero. Now, the United States, the CDC refuses to release the mortality data stratified by vaccine status. They have it. They've had it for years, and they refuse to release it. The United Kingdom did release it, and I did an analysis of that data, and it clearly showed that the all-cause mortality, meaning death from any cause, in the second half of 2021 was roughly twice the number for vaccinated people under the age of 40 in the UK compared to unvaccinated. Now, that's an extremely powerful set of data, and every country that has looked at it has found the same thing. So the vaccine campaigns have been canceled in Britain. They've been canceled in Germany, Switzerland, all the Nordic countries, because they are worried. And, this has been a catastrophe for young people in the last couple of years. And it's quite clear that the most likely culprit is the vaccine. Now, we could settle the issue in the United States if the CDC would release the data, but that's a more highly protected secret than the blueprints to the hydrogen bomb.
So why is the U.S. different than Europe right now? Why are we clinging? And this is where you said before you didn't think it was done on purpose or no negative, nefarious, intent. But the question is, and I'll just ask this plain, has our public health system, the CDC, NIH, been captured by big pharmaceutical? And a lot of this has to do with profits. If you go back, think of the Woody Harrelson. I don't know if you saw it. Woody Harrelson on Saturday Night Live about a year and a half ago came up with a scenario comparing what happened in the U.S. with the COVID mandate to a drug cartel, saying a cartel comes up with a product that's hurting people and not effective, but forces people to take it. And then people, you know, the cartel gets bigger and bigger. Do you see anything? In other words, is our public health captured by the pharmaceutical companies that they would still push this vaccine in the face of all this danger when Europe has walked away from it, from pushing it anyway?
Well, yeah, the short answer is yes. At every level, the regulatory apparatus in the healthcare industry has been captured by the not just the pharmaceutical industry, but the what you would call the medical industrial complex. The people who are making big money off of healthcare have completely captured the process. And it's worse than you think. So you have the obvious situation with why do they not release data? Why does the CDC not appear to do its job? But it's worse in that if you look at how we select students to become medical students and medical students to become residents, the selection process is much different than when I was a young man. So they do not want creative thinkers. They want people with very good memories and who follow orders.
Wow. In other words, I remember interviewing a former professor, a tenured professor who quit because he said they called them obedient intellectuals. The system tries to produce, and whether it's science or medicine, obedient intellectuals. And the idea is you don't question what's coming from the sort of the medical or scientific establishment. So,
right. There's this overwhelming deference to official authority.
Yes. Well, you lived through this in 2020 as a doctor and involved in all this. What in the world happened? We had known decades earlier that mask mandates didn't work. We had known that lockdowns had higher negative consequences than any potential benefit. We knew that isolating people was bad. Yet somehow in March of 2020, the entire country in the U.S. and most of the world went crazy with a few exceptions. Churches closed, schools closed, weddings, funerals canceled, backyard barbecues canceled, stay-at-home orders. And it was just at maximum isolation. People deferred cancer treatments, deferred cancer screenings, and of course, the mental health issues as well. How could a medical establishment in the United States not only sign off on this, but push it with such vigor? How did it happen?
Well, this is a collective thing, so it's hard to say any one cause. But I think basically this was a situation where the elites of this country, their money would not help them. They were faced with a problem. Their money, their status would not help them. And they were afraid. And they sought a solution that would maximize their protection against this virus.
Well, my daughter, when she had COVID, she was trying to get ivermectin. Her doctor prescribed it. And I remember going to CVS, Walgreens, all these retail national pharmacy chains, and they were absolutely refused to give it out. I think it had to do with the emergency use authorization. And if some other medical treatment worked, then you couldn't get the vaccine. The COVID vaccine wouldn't be accelerated because there had to be an alternative treatment. There had to be no other viable treatment. We saw this with other medicines as well. Did you think you'd find the day in America where a CVS pharmacist would overrule a doctor's prescription and say, no, we're not going to fill it? It's not acceptable. That was the first time in my lifetime that happened. What was going on there when the national chains refused to fill any alternative treatment to COVID?
Well, this was the official establishment ridiculing this therapy on the basis of very little information. And I think you're right. I think the reason it was ridiculed was the emergency use authorizations and also indemnification of the vaccine manufacturers from any damages caused by their vaccine. These kinds of things only occur when you have these emergencies that require emergent throw caution to the wind types of responses. So I think they had to have an environment consistent with that. And yes, if you found a dirt cheap drug that was effective in treating the problem, then it would be very difficult to sustain things like remdesivir and other treatments that were being, you know, thrown at the problem. So I think, yeah, in the end, it was money. It was money in terms of like the response to ivermectin. But in terms of the lockdowns, it was just fear.
Wow. All right. Well, we're pretty much out of time, but just one question. How do you see this reforming? Where do we go from here? Make it so you can sue vaccine makers. We have to oppose the World Health Pandemic Treaty, which is going to globally institute these kind of medical tyranny. What do you think in about 15 seconds? What can we do to reform it? Sorry, not much time.
I'm not very optimistic that anything is going to change, but yes, you would have to start by reforming the pharmaceutical industry and, more importantly, reforming the regulatory apparatus of the pharmaceutical industry. Basically, they just regulate themselves.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gilbert Burdine. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. See you next time.